Well, there's nothing people like more than somebody getting their comeuppance. I'd be very surprised if you didn't enjoy the wrong answers that I gave. I enjoyed the moment in the General Synod last February when all the bishops except one voted the same way, and the one who didn't had simply hit the wrong button on his voting machine. And afterwards, everybody was, you know, saying, I'm glad he wasn't elected to the White House and things like that. You know, it's lovely when people get their comeuppance, isn't it? And the story here in chapter 9 is to, in a large part, how the religious authorities of the day got their comeuppance at the hands of an uneducated blind man, or a formerly blind man. But although much of the story is about that, that's not actually what the story is trying to say to us. What the story is trying to say to us is that Jesus is the light of the world. So you find that right at the start in verse 5. Jesus says, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And then right at the end, you get Jesus saying, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. So two ends of the story about how Jesus brings light to people. And therefore, we get the point. This is a story designed to show us that Jesus is the light of the world. So we're going to see how that is established as we go through the story. And I want to do so under three headings. The first is the miracle. Now, normally, if someone is offering miraculous cures, people flock to them. I watched a program not so long ago about this man, Andrew Marr. Do you remember how some while ago he had a stroke? And it affected his left-hand side. So you see that when he's doing television these days, he stands supported by a stick. And this was about how Andrew Marr tried to solve the problems caused to him by his stroke. And he heard that in America, there was a specialist consultant who could do an extraordinary treatment which had resulted in some people having what appeared to be a miraculous cure. So being fairly affluent, he got on a plane and took himself over to America to meet this consultant. Now, he met the lady whose life had been completely transformed by this man, but when he himself went through the treatment, unfortunately, it didn't have the same effect on him. He felt some sort of mild improvement in his finger movement, but nothing dramatic. But isn't that typical of what you might expect somebody to do? If there's a miracle going that's going to meet a real need, you know, you'd do everything you could to get there. But that's precisely not what happens in this case. Isn't that interesting? Here is Jesus, a man known for his ability to cure people, and there is a blind man. But the blind man, it's as though he does absolutely nothing about it. The disciples are going by with Jesus, and they see the blind man, and they have a discussion with Jesus, a sort of a theological discussion about the cause of his blindness. What does the blind man do? Just sits there. You know, instead of crying out to Jesus, heal me, Lord, he's just sort of sunk in his position. It's almost as though this man, having been born blind, has never experienced anything else. He has no hope. He has no expectation of anything ever happening for him, and certainly not someone who is known to be offering cures. It's a man who just, you know, doesn't believe his problem is curable and doesn't look for any cure, doesn't have any hope in his life. And it's into that situation that Jesus walks, and the man's life is absolutely transformed. Retinas that hadn't formed properly at birth are recreated instantly. And what happens is not so much a healing miracle as a creation miracle if he's being given his sight back. Now, one of the questions we inevitably ask, one of the questions I used to ask when, I referred to the time in my 20s when, you know, I was besieged by doubts and I fell away from Christ, was, did this really happen? Is this a story that we can believe? Now, right at the end of John's Gospel, as was being pointed out earlier in one of the mastermind quizzes, John tells us why he wrote his Gospel. He wrote down all of the records of the miracles that Jesus did, he said, so that you may believe Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John is quite clear that what he's writing is fact, and he's recording it for our benefit. It's very interesting that the historical record outside the Bible testifies to the fact that John used to do this. He used to recount the miracles of Christ. There was an ancient bishop of Smyrna who was martyred about a century after John wrote this gospel. And about a century afterwards, this was recorded by somebody who was remembering what this ancient bishop Polycarp used to say. All right, so we've got a couple of generations from John to Polycarp, and then we've got somebody beyond Polycarp recording what Polycarp used to do. This is what he wrote. When I was still a boy, I saw you, Florinus, in Lower Asia in Polycarp's company. I can describe the place where the blessed Polycarp sat and talked, his goings out and comings in, the character of his life, his personal appearance, his addresses to crowded congregations. I remember how he spoke of his intercourse with John and with the others who had seen the Lord, how he repeated their words from memory, and how the things that he had heard them say about the Lord, his miracles and his teaching, things that he had heard direct from the eyewitnesses of the word of life, were proclaimed by Polycarp in complete harmony with Scripture. So this bloke Irenaeus, recording somebody being in Polycarp's company, and what Polycarp used to say about the John who recorded all of these things. Well, they took it seriously. They believed that John was writing what he saw. He talked about them as eyewitnesses. But you see, the story of the miracle isn't here just to show how fortunate the man was that Jesus happened to turn up. Jesus miraculously enables the man to see. And when we get to the end of John 9... we're told that seeing who Jesus is and believing in him is a mark of whether someone really has sight or not. And the Pharisees at the end get the point because they say, are we blind? Because they know that Jesus is actually, when he talks about being the light of the world, he's talking about their understanding of God. If we want to know about God, if we want to know about the purpose of life, if we want to know who we are as people, what our identity is, if we want to know about God's plan for us and for others, if we want to know what hope there is in the world, if we want to know all of these things that are so important to all of us, we need to see who Jesus is. That's what he's saying. He is the light of the world. And if we haven't seen who Jesus is, then we're not going to get the hang of those things. We're going to remain blind. It's such a decisive change when we see who Jesus is that elsewhere in John's Gospel, he describes what happens as new birth. It's like a creation miracle. So that's the miracle. Now we're going to look at the man. I thought there was a title coming up. Sorry about that. We'll wait for a moment. The man. Now, when the man comes back from the pool of Siloam, people aren't at all sure that it is the same man, are they? Did you see that? The neighbours and those, this is verse 8, and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? And some said, it is he, and others said, no, but he's like him. And you can imagine that, can't you? Because someone who is blind either has their eyes closed or their eyes sort of track around the place but don't focus on you, or there's something like that about them. And yet when people can see properly, they do what many of you are doing now. You're quite focused in what you're looking at. I found a YouTube clip which showed an example of two little girls in India who had a blinding deficiency in their eye, but one that was easily operable. And it showed how they moved from blindness to sight. And as we look at these two clips of before and after, we haven't got time to see the whole clip, but look at the two clips of before and after. I want you to notice some of the differences you detect, or some of the things that happen once they've got sight. So let's have a look at this.
সে রোববারের উপেক্ষা করবো, সে রোববারই তো সবচেয়ে বড় দিন আসবে যে আমার বাচ্চারা দেখতে পাবে, অতদিনের পর দেখতে পাইনি।
Okay, so that's before. One of those girls has her eyes closed most of the time, and the other, the eyes wandering around. Then they're taken for an operation. The family can't afford it, but this is as a result of a mission to people that provides this sort of medical help. And we'll look at what happens as they discover their sight.
ব্যান্ডেজটা খুলে দেয়, সে ছুটে নামে আর এমনিতে বলে, মা আমি দেখতে পাচ্ছি, দেখতে পাচ্ছি। তাদের ভবিষ্যৎ যেন ফিরে আসে সেটাই তো চাই মা বাবা, বলো। লাস্ট কথা আমি আর কি বলবো, আপনাদেরকে ধন্যবাদ দেওয়া দরকার আপনাদেরকে।
Well, it's very moving, as you can tell, but did you notice how eyes were open that were closed? Did you notice how at the end the elder girl was focusing on that reed or grass, whereas previously that wasn't possible? Did you notice how they stumbled around a bit when they were first walking, how they smiled and were shocked with light and things like that? So when someone is given sight, having previously been blind, you know, they behave differently. Different things happen. And therefore, it's entirely understandable why somebody should be saying, is that the man that used to sit and beg? I mean, look at him now, compared to what we did know of him. Look at him now. I mean, if someone's looking at you, whereas previously they never did, you'd certainly wonder whether it was actually the same person. But the man himself insisted that he was. And then what happens to him? Well, it's very interesting tracking chapter 9 through and seeing what does happen. You see, the first thing they do is they think that they need to take him to the religious authorities. Now, in those days, that's one of the things you did to certificate a fact that somebody was, you know, well, having been previously unwell. And they take him to the Pharisees, verse 14, we discover it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So all the Pharisees are really concerned about is why on earth this man broke the law by doing some work on a Sabbath instead of actually being concerned at how amazing it is that this bloke got his sight. So verse 15, the Pharisees start to quiz him. And they asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, he put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see. Some of the Pharisees said, this man isn't from God, for he doesn't keep the Sabbath. But others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. So they said again to the blind man, what do you say about him, since he's opened your eyes? He said, a prophet. The Jews didn't believe that he'd been blind and received his sight, so they called his parents in to ask them. Well, his parents are rather scared of the religious authorities, so they pass the buck. And they say, well, he's of age, ask him. So verse 24, they call the man in for a second time. And they say to him, give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. He answered, whether he's a sinner or I do not know, but one thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. They said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered them, I've told you already and you wouldn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples? And they reviled him. Oh, how dare you, you wretched man. You dare to teach us, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this man, we don't know where he comes from. And the man answered, verse 30, well, this is amazing. You don't know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God doesn't listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshipper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And they said to him, how dare you lecture us? You were born in utter sin, and do you teach us? And they cast him out. And it's at that point that Jesus is right next to him. And Jesus finds him, and he says, do you believe in the Son of Man? And he answered, who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Jesus said, you've seen him, and it's he who's speaking to you. And he said, Lord, I believe. Now, I want you to notice some things about that. Did you notice that as he's quizzed about what happened to him, he's continually asked, what do you say about this person who healed you? And did you see how, as he's answering those questions, more and more is falling into place for him? Because he starts by describing Jesus as a man, and then when he's quizzed about it a bit further, he says, well, he's a prophet. Did you see that in verse 17? And then, having said that he's a prophet, he then describes him as one who has been sent from God, in verse 33. And then when Jesus meets him and he sees him properly for the first time, he calls him Lord and he worships him. Isn't that interesting to see his growing faith in who Jesus is? And I think this man was just he was a model, really, of being honest about what had happened. He didn't embellish his story at all. He didn't make things up. He was just honest about what had happened. And as he is honest about what God has done in his life, he realizes who Jesus is, and he calls him Lord. And Jesus then goes on to talk about how he has come to give sight to the blind and give blindness to those who claim they see. Now, in the light of this man's growing faith in Jesus, can you see why Jesus didn't heal him instantly but sent him to the pool of Siloam? I mean, did you wonder why Jesus spat and made some mud and put it on his eyes? It all sounds rather disgusting, doesn't it? But then told him to go to the pool of Siloam and wash it off. Because this man stands as an example to us of a man of faith, of someone who hasn't seen Jesus, but nevertheless trusts him for what happens. You see, when Jesus put the mud on his eyes, he would have felt the touch, but he had never seen Jesus. And when he went off to the pool of Siloam, he didn't know who Jesus was, he just did what he was told. And then he washed, and having done what Jesus said, discovered he had sight. And that led him on this pathway of growing faith in the Lord Jesus, even though he'd never seen him. So we've looked at the miracle. We've looked at the man. Finally, the meaning. The meaning. I said at the start that the miracle is a picture of Jesus being the light of the world, but in the story we see two reactions to Jesus, don't we? The man shows growing faith, and when he's eventually kicked out by those opposing him, Jesus is immediately with him and he worships Jesus as Lord. But the other reaction is that of the Pharisees, who, when they hear what Jesus has done, change from inquiry to hostility. And that's always the result of gospel preaching. It either enlightens people and they realize things are falling into place for them. They realize that Jesus is trustworthy. They realize actually that he is the one who has the ability to make sense of life and the future. He's the one who we can trust absolutely. Or it produces the opposite reaction. It has a hardening effect, either enlightening or hardening. So if you were skeptical, you move to cynicism. If you were cynic, you move to opposition. You're either increasingly drawn or increasingly resistant. And the danger of resistance, as Jesus said in verse 41, is that those who resist remain unforgiven. So the Pharisees heard him saying all these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" Yeah, meaning, we are the people of the law. We have the complete revelation of God. Jesus said to them, "Well, if you were blind, you know, if you recognized how much you had a need of sight, you would have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains." The biggest problem that any of us face is our sin, because that's what keeps us from God. Our desire to do things our way rather than God's way. And ultimately, if we insist on doing things our way, God will say, "Well, so be it." And if he gives up on us, isn't that terrible? Because every time we hear the gospel, we won't hear it as a message of hope. It'll just have a hardening effect. We'll be increasingly dismissive of it. But we don't have to be like that. We can respond to Jesus Christ. We can respond to him and put our complete trust in him, and we're given sight. Now, you'll see from the screen, I've put down three things to summarize there. Jesus is the only one who helps us see life clearly. It does require a miracle for any of us to do this, to have that sight. It requires a miracle for us to put our trust in Jesus. It required a miracle for that blind man to see, and he didn't even know that anyone could help him see. And I don't know, you might have some friends who you would love to be Christians, but you know, you don't think they'll ever get to that point. Isn't it an encouragement to pray for them? Because for all of us, becoming a Christian is a miracle. It's a miracle worked by God. And therefore, even for our hardest friends, we can pray for them because we're praying for that miracle to happen. But let's not forget that if we reject Jesus, well, we're opting for blindness. And that's a very serious thing because it has eternal consequences.